Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. I was talking to a friend the other day and he told me having boiling hot water in the in the kitchen is dangerous. Sorry, I'm only laughing because he did have a kettle and he does obviously heat stuff on a stove as well, which to me seems boiling hot water. The cooker is not dangerous though, as you can't knock it over. And it has a push-twist system, so you have to know how to use it to get the water out of the tap. A child or a friend who just walked in can't accidentally turn it on. It's hard. You have to know the combination. It's a push and twist system. So it's a lovely bit of kit. Boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Mine also does chilled filtered water and chilled sparkling water, which is also filtered. Go to cooker.co.uk to look at the different models there. If you can't afford one, I recommend them. Today's hour, I'm curious about failure. Joining me for conversation is Sarah Steen Librano, who's part of the School of Life organization, who help people lead more fulfilled lives. Failure is a fascinating subject. I'm going to sound weird here, but this is what I believe now in my many years and older years, my wiser years. I'm full of wisdom now, but I've read a lot and I've done a lot of podcasts, and I don't believe there's such a thing as winning or losing. I just don't think that is a correct way. It's a good use of language, but it's a poor analogy to win or lose. There's so much to life. I actually don't believe in success or failure either, and I don't believe in good decisions or bad decisions. There's just life. And that's what's happening. There's life, then there's actions, then there's consequences, then there's dealing with the consequences, then one day there's death and it's over. And then dependent on your beliefs, it either starts again or it's finished forever, or you begin an eternal life in heaven. Something like that happens, depending on what you believe. Being a human, though, eternal life in heaven just doesn't sound. That's a very long time. Eternal. It just sounds like not a good deal for me. It sounds like just Groundhog Day over and over. You wake up every day and it's like I'm in heaven. I'm really happy. I can't see it myself. Anyway, I don't have a religion. Maybe I should get the religions all on here and interview them all and decide one on one maybe one day. Anyway, the book is fascinating on failure. It's really made me think a lot, as you can tell by me spouting all this nonsense in the intro. Let's meet her though. Let's meet Sarah and she can tell us more about it. Here's Sarah. Hello, Sarah. How are you?
I'm good. I'm as good as I can be today anyway. How are you?
All right. I'm very good, thank you. The first thing I want to do is work out what the School of Life is. So this book is written by the School of Life. I don't really know a lot about the organization. Tell me about it.
Sure. So we were founded over 10 years ago now by the philosopher and writer, novelist Alain de Botton, and also many of his friends and fellow faculty members. And we are a collective of writers and thinkers and also therapists. We have a large crew of therapists in our staff, facilitators, teachers, and we focus on how to live a more fulfilling life. So some of the skills we teach are what you might say are involved in emotional intelligence, but we also think about things from a very philosophical perspective. We look at examples from culture and history, and we try to figure out how we can deal with life more wisely, especially when things are difficult. So trying to be more resilient in a way.
Okay, very good. So this book, who wrote it? Did you write it or
all of us wrote it? Yeah, we work on the content together. We teach this content as well, so some of it is drawn from our experience teaching groups of people, and I use teaching very broadly here to mean having thoughtful group conversations, really. So it's a collective of writers, so not just me in any way, but I have worked on this material in some ways, yeah.
So if I was to get involved with the School of Life, is it open to anybody? Is everybody able to?
We have a...
Go on. Mm-hmm.
No, we've got classes for the public. They're often online, so you can join from anywhere. And we talk about different topics involved in living a fulfilling life, everything from how to understand culture better, how to relate to art, to how to get over a terrible breakup, to how to deal with failure in whatever form that takes in our life. But you can also, you know, watch some of our YouTube videos. We have a thriving YouTube channel. We have therapists. If you're looking for some sort of individual consultation, we sort of have the full gamut of things. And of course, we've got an online shop full of books and card games and interesting curiosities.
So what's your background then? How did you get involved and what's your job?
I've been working on our YouTube channel since day one of the YouTube channel.
Since how
day
old is
negative
it, then?
Something. It's how old. Let's see. I'm old. So it's probably about 8 years old now, I would say. I have to check the dates on those emails. But yeah, roughly 8 years old. And I was a little baby researcher for the YouTube channel. At the moment, I'm actually working very slowly to finish a PhD in politics and psychology. So I have a very broad range of interests, but they all focus around how people can live well, either individually or together. And and I have a background as well in designing exciting experiences and learning experiences for people. That's my broad range of things.
It's a fascinating collective. Why has it been put together then? Why did you see a need for it? I'm going to change that question. Is society broken?
We're all broken. But this is actually how we talk about it in the book a little bit as well. We're broken in the sense that we're not perfectible. And also that things are going to go tragically, fundamentally wrong at various points in our lives. We talk about the kintsugi pots, which I think are making a sort of resurgence into popular culture. These pots that are actually often ritually broken and then carefully put back together with gold.
Sorry,
paint.
There's a couple of words I don't understand. Perfectible. What does that mean? I don't know that word. Does that mean
perfect? Well, look, I think if you look at, we can't be made perfect, more importantly. Right. I think certain kinds of advertising or relationships to technology imagine that human beings, if they just did the right things, could become perfect. And we think that that's nonsense, that there's something that's fundamentally more broken and difficult about the human condition. Which doesn't mean there aren't important things we can do to make our lives better, or that we should just despair, but it means that we have to be aware of this fragility.
Right. And what was the other thing you were saying about the
kintsugi pots?
What does that mean?
So kintsugi pots are just a lovely example from culture of this awareness of fragility. They're Japanese Zen Buddhist in tradition, and they are usually these beautiful, imperfect pots that are often ritually broken and then put back together very carefully with gold glue, with actual pieces of gold in the glue. So you see the lines of the break very, very beautifully.
Yes, yeah, and
we point out that if you look at a lot of examples of art in Western culture, what we see as beauty is perfection, something that's perfectly symmetrical, that's not broken at all, that's maybe even like the ideal perfect human body or something like this. And that it's important to be able to look at other examples from other cultures where something that is broken can still be beautiful and appreciated and even very highly valued, because it might be that our own culture places too much emphasis on perfection and equates perfection with this very nebulous concept called success.
Yeah, I'm finding this fascinating, this interview, because you're using the word "we."
It's really just a bunch of us thinking together.
The book is so weird, and I didn't understand what the school of life was, and you've just explained to me, and I'm reading the book and I'm going, this is such a weird book. And I start off by reading it going, I'm just not getting this at all. This is so surreal what I'm reading here. It's like collective thought without the structure of a self-help book, and I've read many of them, by the way, and I've read many books on Buddhism and Stoicism and all that, or everything, right? And they always do the same thing, which is, here's the problem, here's the way to fix it. And in this book, it's just thought processes, and by the end of it I'm going, I'm really enjoying this, because I'm not being told, here's your solution all the time, even though there are solutions in there and there's some really great things. It's a series of thoughts, and that's what it comes across as. Is that what you see it as?
Yeah, I would say, I think this book is two things. I mean, it's many things, but two things that might be helpful for understanding why it seems weird is, firstly, that in many ways we would see this as an antidote to something that's gone wrong, in particular with our current society. So look, I think the School of Life does really well at all the things it does. Of course, we have great advice about how to talk to your spouse and how to figure out a better job for yourself. But I actually think one of the things that we do most in the most unique way compared to other, as you say, self-help literature, is that we are much more realistic about this aspect of the human experience, about failure. We see that it's really a necessary and an avoidable part of the human experience, and that we don't need to dress it up as practice for some other worldly form of success. We can approach it as what it is, which is an inevitable aspect of being a human being. And so one of the reasons why the book isn't posed as a series of solutions is that we're trying to say something about how there won't always be a solution to failure in the sense of moving you on to some success in the future or the avoidance of failure. And then instead, and this is the second thing this book is, we can look for areas of consolation, which really means a philosophical look at what's happening to us that allows us to appreciate it even though it's difficult, or see sort of new ways of thinking about what's happening to us.
Yeah, it's not so much solutions as it's actually supposed to happen in life. And this is what the book I think points out all the time, is this stuff is supposed to happen. A very good example of that is when in relationships, like no, very, very few people start a relationship at 16 at school and then go on for till death, you know, so we're all going to have to go through the end of relationships. And I think a lot of time with failure is you feel very much on your own, and you do point this out in your book, is you feel alone. And just getting back quickly to society, I think society makes us feel very alone because we're told constantly that we should be successful, and failure is seen as failure. We're always got, you know, sport is a great example of this, is there's winners and losers. There's no winners and losers. There's just stuff happening. You know, you can win and feel absolutely horrific. And as you point out in your book, you can win the gold medal or something, or the world championship or something, but you go home and your home life is absolutely tragic. So who's the winner and failure in that? You know, it's interesting the way society is developed at the moment to not have I personally think society is a bit broken. We're creating all these people who are looking to be perfect and they are not, and I think that that's where we're at. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think as a result we don't really know how to talk about this, and when we do it in kind of stupid and superficial ways, and you know, it was a failure but next time I'm going to win. And I think this makes us kind of unlikable as a society. And we talk about this a little in the book. It's not just my personal opinion, which is that people who are constantly successful, or at least present themselves as always sort of ending up on their feet, let's say, are not particularly relatable. And in a way, they're not really sharing anything necessarily very deep about themselves, because it's actually in our moments of failure that we acknowledge our vulnerability. And that's so much of what brings connection with others.
Yeah. When you say, getting back to the point where you say we, and you're saying it there, you know, these are thought processes. Do you all agree on everything you're putting in this book? I mean, no, how many of there are there
no.
of you?
Does
I mean,
the Economist's editorial board agree on everything? We actually think they're a great example, right? There are no bylines in The Economist almost ever. But there are editorials written by the editorial board. And this is sort of the same thing. And the reason we do this isn't sinister. It's not to cover up who we are. It's just that at the end of the day, people often rely on the school of life like an extra writing therapist, right? This is their therapist. They read our books and then they process maybe with their own therapist or through writing or talking with their friends. And in the same way that you don't really want to know that much about your therapist's personal life, we find that if people start Googling all the possible writers and faculty members at the School of Life, they'll over-relate to us. So they start saying, I need to know everything about Sarah's life, you know, and then if they find something they don't like that I tweeted, or, you know, or they think I'm great, either way, it can be a problem because I'm just one person, and that's really not how you should relate to a therapist, right? So because we have a therapeutic voice, we've built a way of writing that is sort of the general opinion that most of us can agree on and that people can relate to, so that even if one of us, I don't know, becomes abducted by aliens or says something odd on the internet, basically you can continue to reflect on your life.
I'm glad you went to abducted by aliens. I like that.
Hopefully not.
So how many of there are there of you?
Well, many. We've got a faculty of, I don't actually know the number of our faculty, but we've got 15 or so faculty members, I would guess, right now. And we've got 20 plus therapists at least. So you have to understand that, you know, as we've built our courses over time and we consult with these people, and of course there's a team of writers as well that just do the writing bit. It's a broad group of people. And we're also drawing from a broad group of sources. We're particularly fans of what is called the Independent School of Psychoanalysis, which are British psychotherapists, psychoanalysts, like Donald Winnicott. So we have sort of particular influences in our tradition as well. And that's why we can use this word we, but it's not that everyone has to think alike. It's just that these are the general things we've come to usually rely on and agree on when we teach and when we do therapy.
Why I love language so I love and hate language so much, mm-hmm. by the way, because I think it's it created my regular listeners will know that I've got a bit of a problem with language. One of the things you've said is abducted by aliens, and now in my mind mm-hmm. it doesn't matter where you're going with this, I just imagine you're all sitting around and someone goes, right, we need to finish this book on failure, and I'm like, No, we want to talk about alien abduction. Right. Who's hands up, who's for alien abduction? Just imagine you're all sitting
around discussing. Maybe that will be one of our obscure books that we write in the future. What does it represent in the psyche? Is it a dream to leave this fragile earth with all of its problems?
Yeah, you're all the school of life, you're all sitting there wanting to go, how can we help? And they go, no, let's talk about aliens instead. I love aliens, by the way. I spend a lot of time online discussing that. All right, so let's get stuck into some of the things in this book. So sure. Obviously the chapter two is the one that draws my attention, just so the listeners know that this is kind of a strange collection, but really, really intriguing and lovely is chapter two, Should I Kill Myself? I
mean, yes.
So right. You obviously get asked about that one a lot. So let's get straight in there. Should I kill myself, Sarah?
No, definitely don't kill yourself. First of all. And we're not trying to make light of this topic because, of course, you know...
You aren't at all, no. It's just sensible stuff you write. Go on.
Well, it's basically just that we think it's important to have a modern answer to this question that isn't merely the answer you get on the suicide helpline, right? That's also important and valuable. And we're definitely not saying people should kill themselves. In fact, we if you feel that way, you should seek help. But we are saying that there are also interesting ways of thinking about this that allow us to reconnect with what is meaningful about life, right? Many philosophers have posed the question of suicide in ways that actually bring them back to the reasons that we might want to live. And I think the reason this is important is that when one is depressed, and even when one is merely very discouraged about life, it can seem like, well, the whole matter is meaningless, especially if one doesn't necessarily believe in a higher power or in particular share a sort of religious belief with many other people in the community. It might feel like, well, look, there's nothing that I have to do because it's a moral imperative. I don't have to keep living for that reason. What's the point? If I'm not enjoying myself, if I'm miserable, why do I have to go on? And we look at some of the answers philosophers have given to this problem and suggest very gently that even if we might not feel in the moment like this is a very satisfying experience, which is especially common when one feels that one's been a failure or has gone through something like a, let's say, catastrophic breakup or the loss of a job, there are still important reasons philosophically to continue. For example, that our existence has an immense ripple effect on everyone around us. This is just one example. There are many other things we say in this chapter, but that's something we don't think about as much anymore. But the fact that if we disappeared, or if heaven forbid we did kill ourselves, there would be people whose lives would be affected forever by us. And I think this is something we emphasize more generally at the School of Life, which is that our lives have a lot of non-immediate importance for other people that we just don't recognize, even though we're very quick to notice that, you know, our second grade teacher had a huge impact on our life, and so did that first really nice person that took care of us the first year of university. And actually our mother's friend who was just really reassuring when our own mother was a bit absent. All these people have quite profound impacts on us, but we rarely think about ourselves the other way around and realize that we must have been that person for someone, and that our own misfortunes, and especially our own disappearance, would affect them too.
Mm. Interesting that you talk about connections with other people. Two chapters that I was really drawn to, and you know, as I say, when I picked up this book, I didn't really know what to do with it. And I've got so many gems in here. How to deal with the pity of friends, and how to deal with the success of friends. Take the pity first, which is really interesting because I always hate. I always think if you say you're a sports person, go back to the sports analogy because it's really easy to understand with winning and losing. And, you know, you're about to win the golf tournament, the Open. It happened to Rory McIlroy once. And then he just lost the plot and just ended up losing everything from being in the winning seat, the winning position. I just watched all the pity from everybody as everybody came round, and like I just thought I would absolutely hate that because I don't believe it. And also that would make me feel even more of a failure than I already did, that I was suddenly getting pity off everybody because they're also bloody successful and I'm not. Tell us about that chapter. What do you think about that?
Yeah. So one of the things that we are looking at is that one of the reasons that failure we look at lots of reasons why failure is often made worse than it has to be. Yeah. You think if you look failure straight in the face, however you define it, although it is painful and difficult, it brings with it a lot of consolations and we can face it directly, but our own culture makes it more difficult for us to do this, and also some kinds of emotional reactions. And one of those is what we term here pity. And by pity, we mean not just that somebody is sad that something bad has happened to us, but in a way specifically that they're sad for us in a way that separates them from us. Yes. So instead of saying, oh, that's too bad, they're saying, oh, that's so horrible. I couldn't even possibly imagine. Of course, that would never happen to me is the implication, even if they don't realize it consciously. That's a thing that's happened to other kinds of people somewhere else. And this is a really painful thing to experience and to sort of see reflected in the eyes of people who are supposedly being kind to us, because we can see that what they're really saying is, that's a misfortune that's happened to you. I'm not really part of the human condition in that way. And it's unbearable, right? It's exactly the opposite of what we really most need when we fail, which is other people to say, yeah, I've been there. Or, you know, I've been somewhere near there.
Yeah, exactly.
And it could happen to me again, right?
Yeah. And I also think it's like, how can I make that person's bad situation about me?
Right. Which is, I'll never do that. I'm more
which,
wise.
Yeah,
more
which wise. Is, yeah, which is often happened. And also, how can I relate to, how can I, if I relate to that amazing golfer, then, you know, even though I was a two-bit crap footballer or something, but I'm gonna tell that golfer how, you know, how he can really go and do it. It's like, you're nowhere near his standard. Why are you even pitying him? You know, you should pity yourself a bit. You know, it's like that's how I always perceive it, and I always see these people jump on everything. And all right, let's talk about successor friends, because that's a really interesting one, because a lot of us get very angry by watching our friends get successful,
and then we're ashamed of it as well.
Yeah, I think it's quite hard not to do sometimes, I think, and it's opened my eyes to a bit, having an honest chat with myself about success. It's not so much friends, but my peer group in TV, who a lot of them went off and became more successful for me. God forbid more successful than me, but they did. and it does feel like a bit like failure sometimes.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think, look, it's interesting. I would say that people often phrase this question a bit like it's about social media, right, or something. For the average person, they'll say, oh, you know, you see that person from your sixth form now has a really fancy London job and are eating extremely expensive sushi on a Friday evening with someone very attractive, and now you're, you know, you feel awkward and it's a problem with social media. But of course, it's not a problem with social media per se, even if that exacerbates things. It's the problem of comparison and envy. And envy is, you know, has been for the last 2,000 years or so listed as a major sin by Christianity and implicitly by the rest of Western culture. But we think it's important to extract from this idea of sin and look at it more plainly as an aspect of how we think about ourselves, right? And how we measure our own success and failure. And to be at least less ashamed of it so that we can begin to be honest about what it represents for us. So that's part of what we're touching on in this chapter, the sort of artificiality of measuring our success against others and the natural instinct that we have to do so, exacerbated by Instagram.
How do you think you should measure success and failure then? I mean, is there such a thing as success and failure? How would you measure it?
Yeah, look, this is a great question. So I think one of the things that's very telling about our society is that if I say, oh, you know, Tim, I've got a cousin, he's very successful. What you'll probably immediately associate is he probably has a lot of money and maybe a very nice car and possibly some fancy career credentials. But of course, the literal sort of definition in the dictionary of success is just sort of you did what you planned to, or you're good at something in a particular area. And so one of the things that we like to point out is that you could, of course, in theory, be a success at looking at clouds, right? You could be really good at looking at clouds. You could be tremendous at listening on a Wednesday afternoon to other people's work woes. There are so many areas we could be successful or a failure at that we first have to question what society has generally placed as success. And secondly, we argue that there are trade-offs here that are inevitable, right? If you're very, very good at Zen Buddhism, at remaining very detached from the outcomes of worldly events, then you might not be the best Secretary of Defense, and you also might not be the best real estate agent, and that's fine. Because both of those are kinds of success. They're just not compatible kinds of success. We think the same thing is present when people talk about work-life balance. We think it's sort of impossible. We have a phrase, anything worth doing unbalances your life. And I think the same thing here applies to success and failure, that at some point, the work of thinking about success and failure becomes incredibly personal and in a certain sense, what philosophers call existential. So doing the work of thinking about it changes the kind of person that you are. It changes your existence. You shape your own existence, and that's what you are. And so you have to choose the kinds of success that you want to pursue and recognize that they will necessarily bring with them certain kinds of failures. You're going to be a bad real estate agent now that you're very good at Buddhist detachment. You're going to be a better mom and you're going to be worse at answering calls from friends that you went to university with or whatever. Only then, I think, can you really own the failures and successes that you have if you've really chosen them.
This is a thing that I'm wrestling with. Desire is a bitch, as we all know, and it just ruins everybody's life. If you can get rid of desire, then you'd be a lot happier. Though I wonder if you need desire as a younger person to achieve something. And if I had my Buddhist and Stoic teachings when I was, and whatever else teachings when I was an 18-year-old man, would I have ended up doing a job that I wanted to do, or would I have developed just sitting around going, do you know what, it's fine, just let life play out? And
I think about this too.
I wonder if you need your desire as a younger person, and then as you get wise, you start realizing that it's just not making you happy. But hopefully, you'll by then have enough money to pay your rent, you know, and buy you some food. So that's one of those things.
Yeah. There's a challenge there, isn't there?
Yeah. With success and failure, I think that, again, going back to the sport analogy, which is so good, is a definite fact this. If you're a great, let's call it Olympian, individual sports person, you will be a terrible family member, because there's no way to be a great Olympian these days without being selfish. So if you've got kids, you don't see them very often. You have to train. You have to go away to camps abroad and leave your, you know, if your kids are at school or whatever, and you have to leave them there, or, you know, you're not allowed to go out and do the things you do. And they all admit it, because they all say, you know, what are one of the attributes of being a good athlete, and it's being selfish. You have to be completely selfish. So you're successful at, I don't know, running 100 meters or throwing a javelin, but you're not successful at that other part of your life. So I suppose if you're going for extreme success, you're always going to have possibly extreme failure at the same time. I wonder if it's better to have a more rounded success and not going for extremes.
I think that there are many areas where that is absolutely true. I mean, I suppose on planet Earth, we're going to have some Olympian athletes and they're going to have their own particular thing. But I think one thing that's very striking is I have taught our class on failure many times. I love it. I love teaching it. But one of the things that's very challenging about it is that many people have kind of the same reaction to the class that you do to this new book that we have out, which is they say, this is really weird. And some of them go much further than that, and they have a lot of resistance. That's the word in psychoanalysis that we would use, right? They find it viscerally uncomfortable and reject large parts of it. And one of the things they most reject is that there's a part where we say, you know, it's actually fine to be mediocre. Mediocre just means sort of in the middle of the pack. Because in most areas of life, if we imagine a bell curve, and not all things are bell curve shaped, but nevertheless, most people are going to be mediocre at most things. And and people are really allergic to this. And I think this is almost a pathology of our society, that we can't allow ourselves to be mediocre at things. We can't allow ourselves to be fine at most things. But I think any other set of expectations for ourselves is condemning us to immense amounts of misery, and not necessarily any particularly larger quantities of success. Most people have to be mediocre at most things, right? And if we are mediocre, as you say, then we might have some time occasionally for our friends, who are having a hard time, or our family, or if we're just looking at the moon before we go to bed or whatever.
How long do you think we've been like that then, thinking that we're all special?
I think that there are lots of different reasons why we have this particularly perfection-oriented culture. I think you could lay some gentle blame at the feet of certain types of Christian theologies that are very averse to sin. I think capitalism has a lot to answer for, because it's an extremely brutal and competitive system where we are made often realistically to feel that if we don't constantly try to outperform other people, we will drown. I think the theory that Max Weber, the famous sociologist, has about the Protestant work ethic and the idea that if we see ourselves succeeding, we'll know we were chosen by God, and the way that's become secularized and we think successful people must be morally better people. That has a lot to answer for, right? The original Protestants really thought that you couldn't quite tell who God was going to save and it was completely up to him, but maybe if you were like quite successful at your company, that might be a sign God had chosen you. And Weber pointed out that we've kind of naturalized that now. We maybe don't believe in God in that way or in salvation in that way, but we do have this weird intuition when we look at LinkedIn that, like, you know, Tim's doing very well these days. He must be a really hardworking bloke and I should try to be like him. And of course, Tim could be succeeding for any number of reasons, or maybe just, you know, saying nonsense on LinkedIn. So there's lots of things about our culture that make this harder than it has to be.
There's a great book by Oliver Burtman called 4,000 Weeks. It's about time and how long you're alive. And the bit which his book actually hit me in a couple of ways. And one of the bits which I've got so much relief out of is when he points out that I'm going to be insignificant in my life. And I did a podcast with him. He said, I didn't quite mean it like that, but I read it in that extreme way that, you know, there's William Shakespeare and Adolf Hitler and Genghis Khan and all these people who have stayed the test of time, Attila the Hun, and who have, most of them have done horrific things, by the way. I don't think Shakespeare killed lots of people, but the others did.
Many of them have.
but there's these people who've stayed in history, but most of us, we're born, we live, we die, and we're pretty insignificant apart from the people around us, which is what you pointed out earlier.
Yeah.
And when I got a massive amount of release from that, because, you know, there is that thing that you're telling me, which I agree, which is the pressure to be brilliant I don't know why, but you're telling me that I do feel that, by the way, that pressure that I want to be a brilliant human being, because that's why I've been put on there. Not, I don't want to be mediocre. And yet the reality is I'm pretty average at everything. And, you know, and so, and I, am I all right with that? No, I am. I'm all right with that.
We're going to try to be.
But I did another podcast with Will Storer. It was called it was all about the self-esteem movement. He wrote a good book called Selfie, and he points out that Thatcher and Reagan really went big on the self-esteem movement in the 80s. You can be better. You are brilliant. You know, there was obviously the American dream, and over here there was Thatcher going, you know, you can go and do it, and capitalism, you know, that whole force. And I think that might have had something to do with us moving away from being, hey, we're part of a society and community. And it's like, no, I'm actually sitting on the edge of this because I'm better than you lot and I'm going to be bigger and better. And I think I'm part of the product of that, honestly, because I come from a pretty average school, state school. And at some stage, I decided in my stupid mind that I was going to work on television when I've got no right to be there. And a lot of people say I still have no right to be
anyone.
There. That's very true. I'm going to read your bit on Fame in a minute because I think that's just absolutely brilliant. You're on Fame. It couldn't be more accurate. But and I decided I think I'm part of that movement. So I wonder if it's a pretty modern thing. And I wonder if you go back to 1910 or 1890 or something, whether people felt more like they're in a community and failure and success weren't as extreme because everyone had failure. Everyone had bad something happened to them where there would be failure. And then you'd be part of a community anyway. So everyone would possibly see it and help you. Whereas now we're pretty much on our own, aren't we? In our strive to be the greatest human ever born.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And you're very, very wisely pointing to Thatcher and Reagan, who of course are advancing a new liberal economic agenda that requires people basically to see their success as extremely individual. That's literally the area that these kinds of economists want people to compete in. But that does require us to see what matters to us as extremely individualized as well. And in addition to all of the many economic woes it brought with it, it also brought with it, I would say, woes of the psyche, right? That we are no longer able to, let's say, be really happy because our sister is happy or our friends are happy or our community is generally doing well, maybe in the same way that we used to be. I think it's very noticeable the absolutely the push towards this very particular sort of ego-based psychology. And I think this is one of the reasons we've written this book, is that, you know, the self-help industry has some answering to do for some of these woes as well. And we want to counteract some of the harm that's done by other forms of self-help that try to convince people that anything that they want to do, they can do if they just think it hard enough, right? I mean, this is a supreme form of nonsense. But it's also profoundly unhelpful for people. It's so untrue. And then they must read the books or whatever and think, but I haven't, you know, become the head of my own company, so I'm a failure. And this is really harmful for people.
I used to sit in pubs years ago and I'd pretend to be able to read them, you know, do that a reading of them. And I used to always say the same thing. You don't feel like you're fulfilling your potential, do you, at the moment? And they, I was like, I can read you, you know, and they'd go, that's right. Because no one, even like, I've done this on my podcast loads of times, you know, from the outside perspective, people think, oh, Tim's done well for himself. He's got himself on telly. You know, I've been on TV for, I don't know, 26 years or something ridiculous like that now. And everyone's going, so in my mind, I'm sitting there going, God, I never got Saturday evening TV. I never made the move to America. I never got my own chat show. I never did this. So I'm always thinking I'm unsuccessful, because if someone came along and said to me, you know, you're not fulfilling your potential, I go, yeah, no, you're right. You're right. How much money shall I give you? How can you make it work for me?
I think this is absolutely the most telling thing. When everyone thinks that something is really personal to them, but everyone has it, then that's a cultural thing. And it might be a really bad one.
we use sport as a good analogy, but I think fame, and this chapter is beautiful, by the way, bearing in mind that I am a little bit famous.
Right.
And I'm on TV and I have got social media and content. This is so wonderful, this chapter, I can't tell you, because it's so bloody accurate. Nice. Oh, it's so bloody accurate, and it's so funny, right? So I'm just going to read a bit from this book because it's funny. However attractive the life of famous people may seem from afar, from close up, it's usually a very different story. Something like the following scenario is, at some stage in their career, uncommonly likely to unfold, right? From the outside, it would appear to be going well. The reviews are ecstatic. The money is flowing in. The hotels are sumptuous and the private jets impeccable. The fans are eager and the dinner invitation from celebrity friends are constant. I laugh at this. This is so brilliant. And yet inside the mind of the famous person, there is turmoil on a scale unsuspected by almost everyone in the entourage. It started with a little niggle, but now it is full-blown state of anxiety that begins at dawn and doesn't let up until the early hours. The famous person, beneath the smiles and the polished routines, will be contemplating the ruin of everything that they have worked for since the start. I cannot tell you how accurate that is. It goes on to say that famous people hate taking holidays. And it's so true. It's like, I've been caught up in that. I don't care as much now because I've done a lot of, you know, you don't know this, but I've had depression and I've spent a lot of time reading and interviewing people like you and stuff like that to try and work out how I am. But I look around my industry. It also goes on to say most famous people are on there because they want to be loved. And it's true. That is true. Yeah. And I hang out with a lot of famous people, and the idea, no, I don't hang out, sorry, I meet them because of my job, and I've spent time at the Pisces stuff. And the idea, if you're listening to this and you're not a celebrity, hopefully all my audience are celebrities, but if you're not a celebrity and you've got the audacity to listen to this podcast and not be a celebrity, god damn you. I know, if you are listening to this, trust me, when you're looking at their lives, it is hell on earth for them, because they know any minute now their career's over. And and it just, it is like that for, you know, there's very few Michael Jackson's dead. Who's really famous at the moment? Whoever it is. Yeah. Lady Gaga. Madonna. She managed
to
keep
behaving
famous,
sort of, lately.
but then everyone hates her for how she's acting now to become famous or whatever. And it's like, and then if you're very, very famous for something like Michael Jordan for playing basketball, your front-loaded life, you're never going to get those highs back. You're now the guy who sells shoes rather than the guy who's shooting the 3 points, you know? So it's a really, it's a brilliant thing, that. And it's a fantastic analogy of what it's like when you're looking at other people's lives and how how bad it can be. Very good. Congratulations on that chapter. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Oh, I'm so glad. The team will be really happy as well, because, you know, we don't have as many famous readers as non-famous readers, but we've got to make sure we hit all the right points.
It is really good, that sort of stuff. And there's also the fear of money as well. And mm-hmm. tell us about that chapter, because you can get money and then, like the fame thing, you're just sitting there thinking, I'm going to lose it, or something's going to happen. And that yeah. fear of failure with money is just huge in all of us, isn't it?
Yeah, I think let's think about them both together, the fame and the money, because I think one of the things that's key about both of those problems is that it seems like a great idea to get some fame and some money, and then you get it and you're not happy. And the question is why? And the answer is, firstly, that neither of those things might have that much intrinsic value. But secondly, that the amount of happiness that we feel tends to be in relationship to our expectations, right? If you wander down the street and you find a $20 bill, or I guess in this country, £20 note, you're delighted. Oh, how nice. If you aren't already immensely wealthy. If you get paid 20 quid when you're expecting to get paid 40 quid for a small assignment at work, you're furious. It's about your expectations. And similarly with fame, right? Somehow there's an expectation that fame will mean that more people love us. I think we're kind of looking for something like love. But love is a very deep thing. The people that write us even passionate notes of appreciation on Twitter or whatever, they can't really love us, because love is, in fact, to bring us back to something at the beginning of the podcast, partially about knowing us deeply enough to know our vulnerabilities. And that's precisely what fan mail doesn't generally know, can't know about us, exactly like the quote you just read. They don't really see the inside of the famous person's life. And so one of the things we point out is that the irony of all of these people in our society looking for various forms of success, like fame and money, is that underneath it is this niggling desire for something else, which is love, and which success almost inevitably cannot bring, and which failure weirdly can bring. Sometimes when we fail, that's when we're able to actually talk about ourselves more honestly, when we find other people who can do the same, and when we can build something that is in friendship, and of course also in other forms of relationships like family and romantic love, really worthy of the name love. Mm. So we suggest that if you think you want success, you should do some reflecting, because it might be that what you really want is love and friendship. And those things, unlike success, are available to everyone who is willing to do the complicated set of thoughtful processes involved in obtaining them, let's say, in achieving them together with other people.
Just for balance, by the way, there are some yeah. great stuff which comes with fame, celebrity, great. which is
what
which
was is your favorite bit?
I'll tell you the favorite bit is I it gave me keys to a world that because people are, for some bizarre reason, people like celebrity, and I get it, because I kind of like it as well when I meet mm-hmm. someone really famous. Like, I once met Michael Jordan. His hand was huge, and I was like, I was very excited that I met Michael Jordan at opening of a Nike store in London, and I was like, oh my god, he shook my hand. And that was kind of aww. Weird, because, you know, this massive man who I'd watched so much on TV. But it gives you the keys. So I got to meet Michael Jordan, and I also got to I've got to meet sort of royals, which is really bizarre when you see into that world, and you start questioning it and going, what's this is really strange, you know, because the celebrity around royals is unbelievable, by the way. I mean,
it's
like,
quite strange
just,
to an American,
it's so because they're just born. What did you do? I was born. And then suddenly right. I mean, you know, it's kind of a really strange, so you start analyzing it. But I've met politicians, and it's really, in a way it's weird, because I've seen behind the curtain, and I would, interviewing any politician now, I'd say, are you loyal to your values? Because I just don't think they are, because the game doesn't let them have any values anymore. They have to curtail to just bloody nonsense all the time and whatever. And then you get, so, you know, you can go and meet the drug dealer in 1 minute if you want, because you've got the keys to that. You can go and meet the royal family the next, or the celebrity the next. And I think that's one of the beauties of it. Also, I got paid some ridiculous sums of money years ago. There's not so much money around now for stuff that I didn't deserve. So, you know, I've got to understand that.
We're not telling people not to be famous.
No, but I just think because people will sit there and go, piss off, Lovejoy. Come on, you've got a nice enough house and all that sort of stuff. You're doing well, but it does make me laugh because you do have this anxiety that you're going to lose it all the time, which is funny. So it did make me laugh. But the best thing about it is the opportunity to speak to so many different people. So this conversation I'm having with you is very nourishing at the moment. And the fact that I've chosen to do this podcast and read these books, I love it. Now, if I was just, if I hadn't done the whole career of television, by the way, I don't make any money out of doing this podcast really, but just a tiny bit to cover the cost. But it's really fulfilling for me because I just get to read
these
books.
Isn't that interesting that what you like most about fame is that it let you connect with people? Fascinating.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And on my show on a Sunday morning, it's 3 hours long and I get to speak to so many different people. And that is what I'm scared of losing. And not the money or with the fame, you also get a horrific amount of trolls.
Right.
And the worst trolls, actually, interestingly, we could move this conversation on to this lovely chapter about deal with the meanness of the media. With trolls, what's really interesting is people forget the worst trolls there's ever been in my career are journalists who are supposed to be professional. They're so horrible. So a journalist will pick up a pen or a typewriter or whatever it is these days, and they will start writing poisonous stuff about me. To sell, to get clicks, to sell their wares, to get paid, to do that. And then they're the worst trolls of the lot. But it's the media is negative for a reason, because that's what attracts people into it. And you know, you have a chapter on this that we've got to be careful of how much exposure we have to this. I've been on obviously the receiving end. I get it, they're trying to feed their kids, they don't hate me, they're just trying to feed their kids, but
it sells.
You know, it sells, yeah, but it is, you've got to be careful you're careful what comes out of you, careful what goes in you, and we've got to be careful how much of this media we take on. Do you not think?
Yeah, we talk about this a lot, and in particular we talk about it in relationship to the idea of tragedy, right? And we mean tragedy here in a specific way related to the originally, at least in Western culture, the Greek idea of tragedy, which is that the Greeks had a lovely thread in many of their plays, which they put on for the public. They thought it was really important that the public watch theater. And one of the things they thought it was very important for people to watch in order for politics and society to function with stories of people who are otherwise kind of likable and have many good aspects, massively screwing up their lives. They thought it was really important that you be able to think about someone as sort of likable and kind of like you, and very good at things, and then one problematic element of their personality means that everything goes tragically wrong. And this sounds sort of strange to our modern eye because we're so focused on success, but it's a beautiful point because it means, firstly, that when we look at people through that lens, we can see them as having failed, but not intrinsically in every way being despicable or a failure, right? And I think this is the opposite of what our modern media does. We make jokes about this in our classes. You know, we say, imagine the story of Oedipus told by modern journalists. It would be completely unsympathetic, right? Journalists do the opposite. Instead of saying, oh, this person has tragically screwed up and everything has gone wrong in their lives, but here are some nice parts of them, and this is just, you know, one aspect. They do the opposite. They say, oh, you've done one, you know, tweet that accidentally triggered the wrong group of people and you didn't really think about it enough, and now you're a terrible person forever. There are no other aspects of your personality. You should be shunned by society permanently. I'm not saying, of course, that there shouldn't be real consequences for people's public views in any way, but I am saying that it's important for us to have a relationship to failure where we can see people who have even massively screwed up as nevertheless potentially having value and importance and other good qualities, because all of us are going to do something at least somewhat wrong sometimes in our lives.
Yeah. Why do we get rid of the teachings of the ancient people? Because they seem to be very wise, don't they? The Stoics and a lot of Buddhism and, you know, a lot of that's from that era, from yesteryear. Why did we get rid of it all? I mean, a lot of Christianity, the teachings are nice, aren't they?
There's some lovely, lovely things in other cultures or even our own that are sort of hidden about failure. I think our relationship to capitalism is a huge part of it. I think it has a lot to answer for. And we talk about this in a particular way. We talk about the fact that our society is built for winners. And this is a real problem, right? Our society works really well if you happen to be in the top 5% of earners. It works beautifully. There are amazing things to do if you earn loads of money. But it works very, very poorly if you are, in any sense, a loser. And I'm putting this in quotes. If you haven't quite got everything together, it works really poorly. You can get more and more enmeshed in debt. There are very few good housing options for you. It's very hard to get out of a hole once you're in one. And not just materially, but in other ways as well, in the way people judge you, in the way they see you, in the way they treat you, in the kind of relationships you're able to form, in the very limited amounts of time you have to yourself. We've built societies, and this is a choice, it's a political choice in the broad sense of politics. We've built societies that are good for successful people and not that good for people who are less successful. And as a result, we're really, really unforgiving and even unkind to ourselves. So I think this is a shift inspired by capitalism and other forces that's really harming almost all of us.
But it's the politicians sell it in, don't they? Like, look at our GDP.
It's like, right. It's a bad political priority, I think.
Yeah, everybody hates their lives, but our GDP. So, you know, you can't, or look at how many A stars we're getting on A levels.
Yeah,
but all the kids hate it. Oh, yeah, no, but look, we're competing with Singapore. It's like, it doesn't matter. The kids hate their education. Why can't we make it so they love their education?
I absolutely agree as someone deeply invested in education. There was this little article that came out recently that said, but look, these children, they did like a blind study and the children that went to museums didn't score any better on their A levels. Well, firstly, I think that lots of exams are really poorly designed. But secondly, and troubling for people's mental health. But secondly, you know, someone just responded to this news article in one tweet and they said, yes, and falling in love doesn't improve GDP. And I think that captures it all, right?
Like, I don't want to get involved in education. I should do actually a podcast on education again soon. But I did get an email home from my daughters. I've got twins, school mm-hmm. once, which saying they're about to take their exams. I think it was GCSEs or something, and they were said, "Look, this is a time that you've got to be very aware of the stress levels of your children are going to go up. We've got therapists on standby, blah blah blah." And I'm thinking, at this point, as an adult, why aren't you thinking, this is a really shit system that we're putting children through, we're supposed to be teaching them about life and the wonderful opportunities and how to be, and instead we're putting them to a state where they might need a therapist. I mean, it's just, you would never get away with that in the workplace these days. Can you imagine sending an email home, you might need a therapist with this work we're going to do?
I actually think we are doing this in the workplace. This is part of why there's this big push towards mental health in the workplace lately, right? It's because everyone knows that actually work is very bad for your mental health in lots and lots and lots of circumstances, and is maybe getting worse. It's interrupting people's sleep more, it's interrupting people's free time more, the phone is always there so you can always be responding to your boss. And so of course companies sort of have to then add all this stuff, just like the school does, to say, oh, we're trying to protect your mental health. But I think the education system and the literal working culture that we face, all of that has a lot to answer for as well.
I want to get onto a couple of methods to deal with failure,
sure.
Maybe thought processes that you've put in here. But before we do that, isn't the most important thing with failure is if you don't care ever of the outcome of anything, then you never fail, because it doesn't matter. If you just think of life as just this rich tapestry of emotions and feelings, and something horrific happens and you enjoy it, right? I mean, you don't enjoy it, but you go, well, it's part of life and I'm going to feel awful, but I want to experience it. Sorry, I'm talking all over the place here, but people down and watch Netflix every night. They get horrified, they cry, they go, what I call emotional tourism. They do that. But as soon as it hits their life in reality, they go, I don't want this. I don't want this feeling. It's like, I'll do it artificially by watching Netflix, but I'm not going to do it by actually having it in my life. But if you embraced it and went, this is going to be, my relationship's just come to an end, I'm so upset, but I want to experience it, because it was a bit like me watching that Netflix thing. If you've got that attitude with failure, then surely you never fail, because it doesn't matter what happens if it doesn't matter about the consequences, the circumstance at the end of it.
Yeah, look, I think it's important not to belittle the fact that many failures are extremely extreme significance to the people that experience them, right? I don't want to come across, and I think it's hard not to do this sometimes with sort of commercialized versions of Buddhism, to say, well, you just shouldn't be attached to any outcomes. But look, some of the failures that people go through in life are immensely important. Maybe their children never want to speak to them again. They became, you know, addicted to something, and their spouse who they loved left them. I mean, there are really serious failures, and just sort of trashing commercial versions of success won't do. There are really grave things that happen to us. But I agree with you that one of the things that we can begin to do is to give those failures the right kind of appreciation, that they are an aspect of human life that probably is going to happen to everyone, that we can at least value experiencing, even though they are negative in some sense. And also, in particular, that we don't need to feel shame about the fact that failures have happened in our life, right? I don't think shame is a very helpful emotion generally. But even if we, let's say, feel shame about something bad we did to our spouse, I think we shouldn't feel shame about the fact that there have been a significant number of failures in our life, because that's what it is to be a human, right? This is the sort of the important insight in the idea that we're all kind of broken, like beautiful little pots. Once we can see everyone else is also broken, then some of the shame goes away, and it just becomes this still painful and difficult and important thing, but less about us being particularly weird freaks and horrible people. And that's important. I think most people still experience their failures as personally shameful and unique, and instead we should see them as general consequences of being alive, and then we can almost appreciate them a little bit as well.
Yeah, going back to the sport analogy, no one has always got a 100% winning record. Everybody loses. Everybody has failure. And I suppose that's the same with us. In every walk of life, you have some form of failure. And as you point out in the book, surround yourself with people who are failures, because they experience the same feelings that you've experienced. And I think that's a problem.
They'll know what things not to say also.
Not to say. Right. Listen, we've got a couple more minutes. As you are the school of life, and I'm fascinated by your organization, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. You might not be able to answer them, but it might be unfair as well. But what is the meaning of life then?
What is the meaning of life? Well, look, we think it would be trivial to give you just one. It's not 42, although Douglas Adams is charming. We tend to look at a number of different areas and help people, much in line with, let's say, existentialist philosophy and the sort of psychotherapies that surround it, choose for themselves, based on their own evaluation, what's going to be the meaning of their life, right? So some example things that we often work with are things like service to others. And this sounds really weird and formal, like we're, I don't know, a flight attendant, although that could be part of the meaning of your life. But we mean this in a really broad sense. People find immense meaning, immense reason to get up in the morning, and gratitude for their ability to just help other people in any way. And it can be a really small way, right? It can be something like, I help my 2-year-old figure out how to put on her shoes. But that is a very meaningful aspect of life for a vast number of people. So we're trying to, when we talk about meaning more generally at the School of Life, get people to focus in on what these key ingredients are. And then also, one of the things that's nice about that is then you don't have to be, I don't know, God forbid, Elon Musk, right? You don't have to be Genghis Khan, who anyway, maybe a bit like Elon Musk, is doing some dodgy things. And you can be you, but you can know which things are really important to you, right? And maybe it's your 2-year-old's shoes, and maybe it's helping her learn something else. And maybe it's actually just being nice to your colleague at work, rather than absolutely definitely getting the raise, and so on.
I think one of the meanings of life is, and this is, I change my mind every week, by the way. I change my mind about everything every week.
Great.
I think that's being very human, but it's just sort of, I think a really good meaning of life is just to sit down and work out what your values are, and then go, right, okay, these are my values. I'm just going to live my life to these values. And so once you've got your values sorted, and then it becomes quite a peaceful existence, I think, if you understand where your values lie.
And you don't, because you're less attached to the outcome in a way. If you think, look, my value is being honest with people, and sometimes I'm going to be honest with them, and they're going to dislike what I have to say, but I have lived out this value. And the good thing is, humans are kind of stupid and very fragile, and we're very bad at predicting anyway whether an outcome has actually been bad or good for us in the short term. So the values can be a much better guide, right? Or these sources of meaning, as I'm suggesting.
It goes back to my intro into you, where I don't believe in anything like success or failure or winning or losing or good decisions or bad decisions. I just think it's life. All right, final question. Thank you so much for joining me, by the way. I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. What happens when you die? What does the school of life think there?
Right. So we are an agnostic, let's say, organization. We don't have, it's all not right. a metaphysical you, belief system.
Get rid of the we then, Sarah. What do
very
you
good.
Think?
Very good. What do I personally think? Look, I am very proud of being Jewish, but many Jews don't believe in an afterlife, and neither do I. But I think that the most important thing is, if you live a good life on Earth, when you're gone, you still matter to some people. And I think about that all the time. I think for me, the idea that when I'm dead, that's the end of it from my action possibility perspective, makes me value the actions I am capable of taking now really highly. So for me, death is really meaningful as a reminder to live life right now in a way that will leave behind something for others.
Well, you're kind of saying there, though, that, yeah, your impact for others is important. So you're basically saying Genghis Khan lived a better life than the rest of us. Because
what's his impact? Good. I don't know about that one.
But he still made an impact. And
I don't
we're still
think it's the scale of your impact.
We're talking about him.
I think it's the good meaningfulness of it. That's what I was saying.
Listen, I've really enjoyed talking to you. Let me know when the School of Life are doing something else and we can pick
We'd
up the conversation.
Delighted.
The book is called On Failure. And honestly, it's such a strange book, which I really enjoyed reading because it is very different from any other book I've really read in quite a long time. I thoroughly recommend that. It's by the School of Life, On Failure. If people want to go to the School of Life and hear what you guys have to say, where do they go? Where's the best way to...
We've got our website, schooloflife.com, I believe, and we've got our YouTube channel, which is a great introduction. There's lots of videos on almost every topic imaginable. So between the two, you should be able to find lots of books and games and classes and therapy and just free articles and videos as well.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.